Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carl from Deviant Legion and the ISF podcast. And as usual, I'm my co-host and producer with me. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel.
Of course,
and
you
all
always
the other
say
people.
That. We're so used to that. And yeah. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Robert Altman. Now, Robert Altman is my all-time favorite director, and I'm very, very pleased to have a gentleman who also tends to agree with me on that. And so let's welcome Patrick Crane. Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk a little bit about Robert Altman.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about what you do, Patrick. I know that we've met each other through Facebook Film Forum and a number of places. But tell us a little bit about your how you got into film and what you do and so on and so forth.
Well, how I got into film is a long story, but I've always sort of had an affinity for it. And as I say, I was sort of precocious as a kid and was into more advanced stuff as a younger kid and wrote film reviews when I was 15 and 16, and then, you know, went to college and studied film and all that. But for the last 17 years, I've spent I spent a career in oil and gas, and recently retired from that. And now I'm back to doing what I love to do, which is write about film. And I did a lot of that freelance or semi-professionally before I got into oil and gas. But you know, once I got into that profession, that sort of went by the wayside. But now I'm freshly retired and kind of back into doing that. And I chose Robert Altman as sort of an exercise to get myself back in the habit of writing, seeing that he is also my favorite filmmaker of all time and that he was very prolific. I said, if I could do a lengthy essay on each film in his filmography in a calendar year, I could write about anybody.
Yeah, and you should also get that published too if you do that, without a doubt.
Well, we'll see.
Certainly, you know, I have some contacts for you, which I'll give you after the show. Magazines,
oh, that'd be
great. And that if you haven't started, I've got some contacts. So, to give you a little bit of background on me, I was thinking about this. I think the first movie I ever saw of Altman's, which I didn't realize was Altman at the time, it was 1970. I was like about 12 years old, and we were living outside of Philadelphia. We got the New York stations, PIX, and they had a Sunday afternoon science fiction thing, and they ran Countdown. But when we moved to Bradford, then of course we got early HBO, and I saw MASH, and that's where I saw most of Altman, particularly during the 70s and early 80s. And then moved to New York, and whatever was being premiered in New York, I would see it immediately. So I have been a huge fan for the longest time. And so I have a couple of questions. If you had a favorite film, and I know that's a hard thing to say about Altman, but if you had a favorite film, can you tell us what it is and why it's your favorite film?
Oh, of Altman's, that one's easy for me. As much as, you know, I love so much of his filmography, my favorite film will always be Nashville. And Nashville is probably my second favorite film of all time. My favorite film being Breaking Away from 79 by Peter Yates. And there's a connection to Altman to Breaking Away. That's how I got into Robert Altman at a younger age was through Dennis Christopher, because I saw Fade to Black in 1980, just as a, I was young, I was like 7 years old, my dad took me to see it, and I was so entranced with this movie, and this movie about a guy who loved movies. My dad had seen Breaking Away, and he had seen A Wedding, and had told me about, you know, how Dennis Christopher played in The Wedding with Paul Dooley as his dad, playing, you know, who's also in Breaking Away as his dad. And then Popeye was coming out later that year in 1980, and that was my first Altman that I saw in the movie. But over the years, I eventually got around to seeing Nashville, and I think I first saw it on VHS, and I think I was in college. But over the years, Nashville has really kind of burrowed into me in a way, and the reason I love it so much is because it says so much about America. I think it's the best movie about America still. Whatever technological advances or crazy things we go through in our culture, Nashville will always feel to me like ground zero of the summation of where we are now. It's sort of a dog year in American history, where politics and entertainment sort of melded together not for the first time, but in a really perverse way, to where we have what we kind of have now. And I think over the years, Nashville will just continue to be more and more prescient. And I think it will have a lot more impact in the future the more people pick up on it and watch it.
Now, that particular film is, again, it's one of his ensemble casts, and it goes all the way through various characters. To me, it's one of his best films. There's no doubt about it. One of the interesting things you should know, later this month, I believe it's the 27th of this month, we're going to have Stephen Eckleberry on. Now, you may not know the name, but his wife, who passed away, co-starred in Nashville, and that's Karen Black. And Karen, did a bunch of songs back during that period of time and even before that they have now remastered, and an album is actually coming out, including some songs that she wrote specifically for Nashville.
Oh,
so,
nice.
So you may want to be interested in that particular podcast when it come up. About Nashville for me is how he handles the characters. I think one of the things about Altman that drew me to him is that he's a humanist. Mm-hmm. He looks at his characters, warts and all, and doesn't judge. Seriously, does not judge.
Definitely.
And he sees the humanity in every character, even to the smallest, character on screen, as far as, minor characters and such. And that's what I love about him. Now, for me, if I'm talking about my favorite film, there's no question. It's always going to be The Long Goodbye. Long Goodbye, to me, is my all-time favorite film, will never be surpassed. And there's a number of reasons for that. And I always go back to Pauline Kael, who says, when you first see a film, it's your reaction to that makes it special to you. And at that point in time, you don't really need to go back and revisit it. Maybe much later, but not then, because it's already had the effect. When I first saw The Long Goodbye in 1974, I saw it on HBO. Previous to that, I did a lot of reading when I was young, and I read two types of books. I read science fiction, and then I read hard-boiled mysteries, particularly Chandler, Hammett, those type of books. And I had actually read The Long Goodbye before I saw the film. And being somewhat frail and that sort of thing, I never saw myself as Philip Marlowe, though I loved the character, until I saw Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe. And suddenly I'm looking at him portraying Marlowe and saying to myself, that's me, particularly that opening with the cat.
Right.
And just how he is so, underrated by the other characters in the movie. They don't really think he can do what he can do, but he does. He's the one that figures it out. And the cast of that film is just fucking amazing.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Wonderful. And
I was thinking about that the other day, and how Mark Rydell, what an inspired piece of casting as Marty Augustine he is.
Well, you know,
and
he actually
wonderful.
lobbied Altman to do that role simply because he wanted to work with Altman and see what Altman did with his actors. You know, by that time, Rydell was a well-known director. He'd done Cinderella Liberty and a number of other films. And just amazing that you have all these actors and all these directors who want to work with Altman just to see how he does what he does. You would agree with that, correct?
Patrick is back.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. You disappeared there for a moment, sir.
That was on my end. I had a technical difficulty on my side. I think I touched something and it dropped the call on accident. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. Trust me. With Blog Talk, you never know what happens. We get raptured all the time. So it happens.
Right.
But what I was saying about Rydell was that he actually lobbied for that role. He wanted to work with Altman to see how Altman directed. Because he was like fascinated that you have all these characters who are, you know, improvising and working. And of course, we're not even getting into the how he dealt with his sound design and the overlapping dialogue
right.
and all that sort of thing. But yeah, Rydell was absolutely fantastic in that film.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Go right ahead, Patrick.
Oh, I was going to say, that was one that I came to later, and it was one that my dad was always a big fan of, that MASH, but I didn't get a chance to see it until later, and it like you, it made quite an impression on me, having been a big fan of The Big Sleep and seeing that incarnation of Philip Marlowe. And so there was something that when I saw The Long Goodbye, the point in my life that I was in and seeing this kind of shaggy, slacker-esque kind of guy stumble through this hazy 70s L.A., I mean, it really hit all the sweet spots for me and still does. And it's one of my – it's in my top five for sure.
You know, and they – also, Altman loved to call the character Rip Van Marlowe because it was like he was asleep for 40s and 50s and 60s and woke up in the 70s and like, what? Where the hell am I? You know,
Oh, go ahead.
You know, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it's you know, and it kind of functions as a semi-sequel to The Big Sleep, seeing that it's got the Lee Brackett connection. You know, that she wrote both.
Absolutely. Now, of course, when you write a script for Altman, that script isn't going to come in verbatim, that's for sure. There was an article with Brackett after the film was released, and someone asked, are you validated by the film? And she said, absolutely. Of course, she's the one that came up with the ending, which most Marlowe purists and Chandler purists absolutely hated.
Right.
No, but I fucking love that ending. It's perfect.
And that was a sticking point. That was a sticking point for Altman. He had to have that ending.
Yeah.
That was a thing. That was, he had to have that ending. And it was so shocking. But to Altman and to her, it was the only thing that really made sense with that character.
Mm-hmm. And with how that character was portrayed.
Yeah.
No. Absolutely. You know, I'd love the last line. Yeah, I even lost my fucking cat.
A cat. Dang. Right. And then Jim Bouton, or Jim, I love, and you know, that's a weird piece of casting. I mean, you know, him not really being an actor, but you know, being that you know, wrote that baseball tell all, whatever that was. I forgot what the name of that was that he wrote that was so scandalous.
Yeah.
What was it called?
Ball Four.
Oh, that's right. But
yeah,
yeah,
another one of the casting is Nina Van Pallant, who had never done a film
right.
before either.
Who shows up then, you know, who kind of keeps popping up in his, I love how he uses people, and then they sort of find their way into his troupe, either as, you know, an actress, but I think she also contributed to, I think, Quintet, the story, or the screenplay,
yes, she
or
did.
Something, I believe.
She
or,
did.
Or is that Pat Resnick, who also did, I think.
No. No, I think she was involved in that. I'm not,
right.
I'd have to check that to be sure. I don't really know. But I think she was.
She's in it. I mean, she's in it for sure. And
yeah.
And I might be confusing the screenplay with Patricia Resnick, who wrote Quintet. But I also wanted, I thought maybe Van Pallant also was one of the screenwriters on it as well. But she, you know, but she of course pops up throughout his film. She shows up in O.C. and Stiggs, of all things. She shows up.
Yeah, if I have to say, like, the most underrated, or at least my guilty pleasure in Altman, it's got to be O.C. and Stiggs. I freaking love that movie, and nobody else seems to.
Oh, I love it. I you know, I just watched it again because it was I think it was the last one I reviewed. I'm getting ready to do Fool for Love, but I, you know, and I'd seen it before. I've seen everything. These are all rewatches for me. But you know, O.C. and Stiggs, I just, you know, in hindsight, it's so smart. It's such a smart movie. I love its connection to Nashville. I love how it plays sort of like a teenage MASH in a way. I love its take on Reaganism. I love Paul Dooley. I love Jane Curtin. And I think it's smart. I think it's one of the smartest teen sex comedies there is, and that's really to call it a teen sex comedy is kind of unfair because it's not really that, but it was made to be sort of in that milieu, that the John Hughes and the, you know, bawdy teen comedies of the time, but it's so smart and it's so good. And I wish somebody would pick it up and give it a Blu-ray release. That DVD that's out is horrible.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing I have to say, and we have to say about all his films, is the music. Now in O.C. and Stiggs, it's King's Sunny a Day. But you know, you take a look at what they did with The Long Goodbye and that theme by John Williams. And Rachel, if you're
right.
listening, I know you have wanted to say something about that.
Well, actually, I was going to joke when you first brought it up. It's your favorite movie because of John Williams, right?
yeah, right.
No. Right. Well, when I was watching it, I was a little stunned because, you know, I'm very, very familiar with John Williams. I mean, he scored most of the movies that were prevalent in my lifetime, so... John Williams is kind of a thing. If you're my age, you can't love him or hate him because he's always stuck in your head. I was really stunned when I saw the credits or the opening credits, and I was like, John Williams? Oh, I mean, like, that's kind of a normal name. But no, I did my research. It is the actual John Williams. And Carl and I aren't sure on this yet. I swear I did my research. John Williams gets credit for singing the song in The Long Goodbye too, which surprised me because, yeah, I'm just used to hearing his orchestral stuff. So that was really interesting to look into. And Carl was actually the one that was telling me that that everything in the movie is all just based on that song, like including a doorbell at one point. So
it's and a mariachi band, which I love. I love the mariachi band.
Yes, right. Where they have the music taped on the back of each other as they're going down the line.
That was the only way they could play it because they couldn't memorize it.
Yeah.
They had to do the shoot in 2 days.
Right.
So they
figured
that out of expediency.
Right. Yeah, I love his music in that. I love his music in Images, the Susanna York Altman film from 72. That's a great, unusual John Williams score, very haunting. That's a great, of course, that's a great horror film. That's a great film. But I love his stuff in The Long Goodbye, and I do love the way that they utilize that song in so many different ways. It sort of reminds me of what Brian De Palma does in Phantom of the Paradise, where they kind of rework that same tune over and over and over again. So, I think it's real clever, and I think it's neat. And the doorbell thing is a really fun bit.
No, I mean, we could just do a show on Long Goodbye, and I could go on for 2 hours, but that's not what people want to hear. So, is there a particular film that you want to talk about, that you've written about, that you think either that you love or needs more attention or whatever the case would be?
Well, you know, I mean, when you talked about the underrated, your most underrated, and Ocean Stigs, you know, it has to be because it's sort of a knee-jerk one that everybody sort of goes to flame Altman. There are much worse. Like I said, I really think it's a strong film. I don't even think I need to make excuses for it. I think there are actually films out there that he made that are far, far, far weaker than that. I haven't watched it this time around, but Beyond Therapy, I recall not being one of my favorites the last time I watched
Beyond
it.
Beyond Therapy is his worst film, as far as I'm concerned.
That was what I took away the last time I watched it. It was like incredibly weak. So it's coming up, so I'm sort of halfway excited, halfway not to revisit it. But, of course, the one that I think deserves attention because it's gone and lost is Health. I love Health. I think there's almost an episode in Whatever Happened to Health and why it is that Health has just never been released, really. When you think about it, it's an odd thing to have a movie that has that kind of star power. You know, in 1980, you had Lauren Bacall and Carol Burnett and James Garner and Dick Cavett. And you've got this, I know what happens at 20th Century Fox that causes that. I mean, you'd think today there'd be a boutique label. You'd think somebody would have tried to pry that away from Fox, but it's just gone. And you can only see it in BitTorrent rips and on YouTube and whatnot. And it's a shame because Health is a great, great movie, I think.
Well, I haven't seen that since the 80s, so I can't really say. I know my first impression of it was – it was good, but it wasn't top-notch. But I'd have to revisit it because I don't remember a lot of it, actually.
It's a fun movie to watch. I mean, in that, again, he seems to, in sort of trying to draw a parallel to the presidential election in 1980 with Ronald Reagan as the Lauren Bacall character, you know, he again sort of taps into something in our American political system and how it's, you know, interwoven in our, you know, entertainment and our brand, sort of brand the foods and the stuff that we get involved with. I love how he explores that in a very kind of farcical way, but he hits on a lot of truths. And of course, I think all the performances are great, and Alfre Woodard especially, I think, got the biggest shaft because she is so good in that movie. Had it gotten a release, I think she might have gotten some recognition a little bit earlier because she's extremely good in that movie.
You know, Doug, that's one thing about Altman's films. Even on his weaker films, the acting generally is top-notch. He was an actor's director. I mean, if you take a look at it, what was he doing that other directors were not doing? I mean, there's this sense of course, improv, but it's controlled improv.
Right.
There's just so much, you compare it to other directors, and I mean good directors like Pollock and that American directors. Nobody else was doing Altman.
No.
Nobody else could.
You know, I notice that one thing that he did that I love, of course, like you said, it was improv, but controlled improv. He would obviously give them the parameters in which they could work, but as he said, everything was two-dimensional until the actors brought the performances in it and gave life to the piece. And so there's a level of trust there that I think the actors then appreciate, and then they give back in return, and it really does make the piece live, even the ones that aren't so good. But, you know, go ahead.
No, keep going.
That was really where I was going with that, I think.
Yeah. Talking about the political films, I need to bring up one that I love, which I think is just probably the most amazing performance in an Altman film. And that's Philip Baker Hall in Secret Honor. Now, that was done during the 80s. Now, once Popeye had been released, he sort of was on hiatus from Hollywood. And so what he would do is find these plays, and he did some for PBS. But he would do, like, Secret Honor was done when he was, I think it was the University of Michigan. It might have been Michigan State. I'm not sure which one. But he had all the students there. He got Philip Baker Hall in. They did the whole set design, and he just filmed it. And for those that don't know the film, it's basically based on a play by Donald Freed, who was one of Nixon's speechwriters, I think. But he was in the cabinet somehow or something like that. And it's a fantasy on the last night of Nixon's presidency. And he just basically gets drunk and just goes crazy. And Philip Baker Hall, how that man was not nominated for an Oscar and win an Oscar for that, I have no friggin' clue. It is just one of the most amazing performances I've ever seen.
Absolutely. I mean, and what I love about Secret Honor is, you know, with Altman, you have movies like Shortcut or Nashville where you have, you know, over 20 main characters. He could do that, or he could do something like Secret Honor where it's just one person and still make it cinematic. Obviously, the material and the performance has to be of a certain caliber to really carry it, and obviously that's the case. But it just goes to show sort of the breadth and the ability of Robert Altman to deal with the largest cast you ever saw, or, you know, the barest of them all. So Secret Honor, that's what makes it such a powerful triumph beyond the obvious with Philip Baker Hall, because, again, like you said, that performance is off the charts. I think like you, it's one of the best performances in an Altman film.
Oh, without a doubt. And the other thing too is he's doing this in basically one room. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But with his cinematographer and with his set design and how they move the camera and everything, it's not a static film at all.
Mm-mm, no. No. He finds a lot of cinematic value out of, Pierre Mignot was a cinematographer during the 80s. And most of all of his film plays is Pierre Mignot. And he just had this real probing kind of eye in all where, you know, even all of these movies are set in one room, Five and Dime, is Streamers, Secret Honor, you know, these are all mostly set in one place. So, you know, you have to have a restless camera to get some cinematic value out of it. And, you know, the utilization of the monitors, you know, this is, you know, that are outside of the house and whatnot, and always watching him on TV, where we're watching him on the screen, but also watching him through a television monitor and shifting to the various portraits on the wall. And it's just a very interesting way to really show how much information you can convey with so little, just through the cinematography and performance.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you mentioned the monitors. For those who have not seen the film, that last minute and a half at the end of the film where he focuses on the monitors to fill a bigger hall screen, fuck them! It's just
right.
Brilliant, brilliant film. You know,
right. Seriously. And over the credits running over the chance of four more years in 1984, which isn't too thinly veiled that, you know, that Ronald Reagan is probably on his way to another term in office. I always feel that, that's there's a parallel there.
You know, and I mean, even in our politics today, if you look at that and you just change Nixon for somebody else, yeah, it's kind of scary,
oh, sure.
Isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, then you go back to, I mean, that's why you go back to Nashville. And you watch, you know, where Nashville, I mean, this populist guy that's running for president on these goofy ideas, you know, but he's making headway. He's winning these primaries. And I mean, Hal Philip Walker is most definitely not fit to be president. I mean, you know, for every one good idea he has, you know, 10 others that are staggeringly bad. And they're just,
right.
It's just this kind of populism that sounds good, but it, you know, really is just not, it's not really productive. And what's funny about that character, Hal Philip Walker, is that he pops up 10 years later in Ossian Stiggs as a senatorial candidate in,
yeah,
Arizona, in Barry Goldwater territory. I think that's a nifty touch. But I see, I think that's why I love Nashville so much, is that I can almost see that, like, I say 1975, that's where it all went wrong. That's where you can see where America kind of broke in a way. That's not really true, but in the filmography of Robert Altman, who I feel is the filmmaker who weaves the best American tapestry of all the American filmmakers, that's where I think he sees there's a fissure that he displays in Nashville that I think sort of came true in our culture, and we see the results of that now.
It's funny, you came up with a word which I think is absolutely prescient for Altman, and that's tapestry. Because his old films are a tapestry of America.
Yep.
You know, most of them anyway, maybe not Vincent and Theo, but that was actually done for TV. But
right.
And then of course, you know, we won't really get into it at this point, but Then you've got Tanner.
Right.
Tanner 88. You know, again, he has this sense of looking at the history and the places in America through a political lens and through a humanist lens. But the tapestry is there all the way through any of his films.
Oh, yeah. Even the movies that aren't set in America that, like, say, that Cold Day in the Park, it could be America. Yeah, I mean, Gosford Park has an American character in it. You know, like, things like Popeye are kind of cockeyed views of America. Quintet, you know, who knows, Vincent Theo, and, you know, but for the most part, his movies were about America, and they were about a lot of times just sort of a middle ground America. There was a ground level view of everything. It was very mundane, like California Split. You know, this is the stuff that kind of interested him, the grout of America, you know, and that's what I think is interesting about him. And to your point earlier about what a humanist he was, how he saw everybody, regardless of who they were, as they went through the American experience, there was a pity on them. He took pity on everybody, but it never really looked down on anybody. And like you said, was never really judgmental. And that, I think, is probably what that's why also I think Cassavetes is probably my second favorite, because he was like that as well. And I just think with Altman, there's much more. It's probably why he kind of wins out over Cassavetes as far as my favorite. I mean, Robert Altman's filmography is both vast and wide, and, you know, Cassavetes is kind of, you know, limited. But I do love that about his work, that how much he cares for his characters, regardless of their circumstances and flaws.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned California Split, which is in my top five of Altman. And it has a line at the end that I think encapsulates the 70s. And it's after Siegel has won all the big money and that sort of thing, they've gone through this whole thing of gambling addiction and that. And he's at the baccarat table with the singer at the end. This is L.A. Gould. And just looks at her and says, it doesn't mean a fucking thing, does it?
Right.
Doesn't mean anything. You know, and it's those types of comments on American life. Of course, the 70s was like that for anyone who hasn't really looked at the films of the 70s. It's one of the most depressing decades ever in film, because nobody seemed to get what they ever wanted. Nobody
right.
had a happy ending. But at least the characters in Altman survived to live another day.
Yes.
And they kept their hope up. And I think that's one of the great things about his humanism. Is that's very much on display, and that attitude.
Yes. And I love that carries. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was.
No, I was just going to apologize because I've got sinus. Go ahead.
Oh no, you're fine. You're good. You know, earlier you said something also I wanted to say, and while I love his humanism, I love how well he punched up. Because as you said earlier, after Popeye underperformed, and it wasn't a flop, it just didn't do what Disney and Paramount really kind of thought it was going to do. And that sort of was the last straw for him, and he was sort of in exile. And I think his 80s work is really underrated. I think it's all very interesting. And at least three of the movies in there, I think, are just outright amazing. But I love that when he comes back after Vincent and Theo, which he does for British television and gets recut in America, for theatrical release. I love when he comes back with the player. He gets welcomed back into Hollywood with a big fuck you to Hollywood and calls them a bunch of shallow phonies. And they welcome him back with open arms. And it's like the player is one of his most critically lauded and loved films. And yet it is just a big giant, you know, up yours to Hollywood. I love that.
Well, it's his most acid film.
Oh, yeah.
That's the way I put it.
And
by acid,
kind of
I don't mean
humor.
Drugs. I mean acid. It's just
right.
it's bitter and nasty, and it just basically middle fingers, middle toes, whatever stands up in the middle of you, that's what it is.
Yes. It's phenomenal. I mean, it's phenomenal that, you know, here's a guy that got kicked out of Hollywood basically, you know, 12 years before. He, you know, after an incredible run, he comes back and this is what he makes, and they love it. It's just, it's such an amazing turn of fortune for Robert Altman. The player is, and you know, I still think it's one of my, it's in my top 10 probably. But I just love his kind of wicked sense of humor, and that's such an Altman thing to do. That feels like something that Trapper John or Hawkeye would have done.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And of course we haven't even talked about MASH yet. But I do want to go back to Popeye because this is a film I think is probably one of his most divisive films in a lot of ways.
I agree.
I love it for a number of reasons. Okay, number one is I'm a Harry Nilsson fanatic.
Right.
I think the script to that is just the music to that is wonderful. A lot of people don't like the music. A lot of people didn't really feel that the film held together. I think they don't realize it's not exactly based on Popeye, that it's based on Thimble Cedar instead. But the thing I really love about it, yeah, well, I'll get to you in a second because I know you want to get into this. But one of the things I do love about the film is that you can look at the film, watch it 2 weeks later, and see so many different things you didn't notice the first time. You could do that for a year. Watch it 26 times, and you'd find stuff new every time. You know, just the way that the production design of Sweetwater, all that. And I'm sorry, but Shelley Duvall was born the friggin' play Oliver.
Oh, for sure. And just real quick to your point, Popeye underperformed, but not due to anything I did, because I saw that three times in the theater when I was seven. I would have been seven because it came out in December. I have seen Popeye. I couldn't even tell you how many times. So, you know, during this exercise of going through this stuff in chronological order and writing these things, I watched the new Blu-ray, which is the first time I'd seen the Blu-ray and, you know, since I'd purchased it, whatever, last year. This is the first time, I've seen this thing, again, a million times over my lifetime, that caveman that just pops up, you know, like in the frame, in the corner of the frame, like throughout the beginning of the movie, He's over that movie, and I never noticed him before. It's a crazy. So I was like, "Oh my god!" Like this production design is so alive that I'm still 40 years later. 41 years later now, I can watch this thing and still see things I've never seen in it before. I mean, it truly is an amazing visual achievement, Popeye. And like you, I'm a huge fan of the music.
So I need to bring on the devil's advocate now. And Rachel, I know you're chomping at the bit. Okay, so go
I'm
for
not.
It.
I wasn't a fan, but considering when I saw it, you know, I saw it in the mid-90s, and I was told it was Popeye, it didn't quite hit with me like it did most people. But beyond that, I don't have a whole lot to say about it. I was listening to you guys. It's been pretty interesting so far.
Well, don't you have a story about being at a wedding? Wasn't that you that told me that?
Yes. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I'm pretty sure these people live out of the country now, so I can tell this story on the air. I knew a couple when I was younger, and they were close to our family. I helped, you know, prepare for their wedding and everything. And she looked like a blonde olive oil. She was this tall Scandinavian blonde woman, and she was skinny and bony, and she had all the knobby knees and the knobby elbows. And she ended up marrying a man who was an opera singer, and he was quite the picture of an opera singer. I'm talking probably like 8.5 feet tall and 30 feet wide. The dude was huge. And the funniest part about it is his name was Ludo. Not
Ludo.
Ludo.
Or Blue?
Ludo.
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 Not Bluto. Ludo. But close enough. So here we are at this wedding with this, you know, skinny, knobby, blonde woman in her giant, floppy wedding dress that had this giant, floppy bow on the back of it. And every time she moved, the bow would flop this direction, and then she'd move again, and the bow would flop that direction. And she had her bouquet, and as opera singers do, they have quite the ego. He had to sing his vows. As he was singing his vows, she had her bouquet and she was holding it up at her shoulder and gazing up at him lovingly, and this bow was flopping all around, and the only thing my mom and I could think was, "Buddy's large."
That's awesome.
That's the only thing I remember from that wedding. I know that it was this beautiful wedding, all of that. The only thing I remember is I had just seen Popeye for the first time, and my mom and I looked over at each other wide-eyed, and the church just like, "Oh, my God, are you thinking what I'm thinking?" Yeah.
Yeah.
And as soon as we got back out into the car, we both said it. We were like, "Buddy's large." And
awesome.
That is my special connection to the movie Popeye, is I swear to God, I saw Olive Oil and Pluto get married.
Hey, that's awesome, though.
I mean, that's
awesome
close
story.
Enough, right?
Right,
yeah,
no,
yeah.
I know. It's totally, I mean, it's close as, it's as close as you'll ever see, I'm sure.
Exactly.
True. One other thing I have to say about Popeye is, let's face it, there were a lot of drugs. There are stories.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I mean, Robin Williams was
involved. Tell a story about Harry Nilsson. So Harry Nilsson was known basically for hanging out with John Lennon and having these weekend debaucheries, where they would just,
mm-hmm.
you know, do so much drugs and so on and so forth. And Harry Nilsson is the only person on the face of the earth to ever been knocked out cold twice by Pam Grier. That's another story. I'll tell it later. But that's true. He was knocked out twice by Pam Grier on two separate occasions.
For sure.
Okay. But so at the time that this was being filmed, this was Robin Williams' first film, and he had just gotten into his cocaine habit. And they had supposedly a cafeteria table that had this huge line of cocaine with a backup pile just in case. And Robin comes in and does a line and like says, "I am the king of cocaine." Harry Nilsson walks in like, "Yeah, really? And I guess Harry Nilsson did about a quarter of the table.
Oh, wow.
I mean, seriously, it's surprising he lived as long as he did. He died in his 50s.
With the heart condition that he had, doing that much cocaine. But, you know, yeah, I mean, Harry Nilsson lived pretty rough. I mean, and, yeah, that lost weekend with John Lennon is, of course, legendary. But the Pussycats album was really good. So, I mean,
and it was several. It was several. They did it many times. And that's one of the things that they talk about Popeye is that there was an excess that is excessive. And perhaps maybe it is, okay? But it's excessive such an artistic level that you can't, it's not a train wreck. It's like this giant mural that Hieronymus Bosch made that runs the length of the town and you just can't stop looking at it.
Right. Yeah. It was 1980. Cocaine was the thing. Robert Evans is, I mean, what do you expect? I mean, obviously there's going to be illegal substances on the set. And I think the movie had a lot of issues. I think its chief problem at the time was, like you said, is that most people didn't know from Thimble Theater from Adam. I mean, they didn't know that origin of Popeye. What they were used to was the post-Fleischer Paramount shorts where, you know, Popeye's mowing his lawn and, you know, Bluto lives across the street or, you know, whatever. They've taken these characters and kind of put them into a real sort of America where Sweet Haven and the Thimble Theater world was this sort of cockeyed view of America, which is what comes through in the movie. But I think that people didn't know any of that. So, yeah, they don't know that all those characters that are on the screen, they all have backstories and they are integrated into that strip. That Bill Irwin's character is Olive Oil's ex-boyfriend.
Right.
So
now, and there's,
so yeah, I mean,
there's so much to look at that film, and all I can say is anybody who hasn't seen it, give it a shot. You might not like it, but you can't say it wasn't interesting.
Correct. And that Blu-ray is gorgeous, by the way. That new Blu-ray that Paramount put up. I mean, that movie looks better than it, you know, it looks as good as it did when I saw it in the theater. I mean, I'm so pleased that that's out. It sounds great. The extras are fun. They really did a good job on it for the kind of, you know, small release that it was. I was very, very pleased. Of course, I'm always pleased when Robert Altman stuff, you know, finally sees the light of day on Blu-ray or some kind of high def transfer. So,
right. Exactly. So the one thing that I do want to get to for sure is let's talk a little bit about MASH. Now, MASH was the movie that brought him to the mainstream. We're talking 1970 or 71, actually, I think. And, of course, you know, they made a TV series out of it and that sort of thing. But to me, if you say MASH to people, they're going to immediately think of the TV series. But to me, the movie is so much more than that in less than 2 hours.
Oh, yeah. Yes, for sure.
And this is really, you know, when we talk about the humanism, even something like Frank Burns in the film or Hot Lip Houlihan, who are basically, you know, destroyed, even those characters you care about in a certain way. And you understand, you know, they talk about now through the prism of Me Too, you know, that there's all this abuse and sexual abuse and so on and so forth. And I'm not saying that's not true, but there are reasons for it. And the other thing is that, to be honest, Trapper and Hawkeye are not nice people. They're not.
No, they're not nice people. They're put into a position where they have to save lives, and I mean, you know, they sort of have the military kind of where they want them, and they get away with a lot. And yeah, I've come around, you know, on my views on MASH, where I was a little more hesitant to say, oh yeah, well, that's just kind of how things were at the time. And I still agree with that, because I still think a lot of the ire that's aimed at Frank Burns and Hot Lips is more of an authority one and less of a
exactly
explicitly
anti authority.
Right. Because in helping a lot of the other females in the camp don't like her, and they help them pull these pranks on her. Now, that being said, you know, this is a movie that was written by a man and directed by a man, and so there is that kind of question. But I think that even if it's latent in its misogyny, I think that it's more directed at authoritarianism than it is really explicitly sexist with the pranks that they're pulling and all of that kind of stuff. Because ultimately, you know, Hot Lips becomes a character that's endeared to them. Now, you could say, well, they broke her down and all of these kinds of things, but Altman still seems to care about her in a really kind of sweet way. And I love how she becomes part of the gang in a way.
Well, she's a cheerleader for the football.
Yeah, she's playing poker with them in that shot where they're driving the bodies away after the football game, where they have all the money, they're playing poker in that tent,
right.
And she's helping. And I don't know if you probably know this, but you know that scene was recut, because that was supposed to be Ho-John that they're leading away, or that they're driving away, the body of Ho-John.
Right.
That was part of the movie, and they cut it out and reshuffled the scene, and they lost that Ho-John gets killed. But that was what that scene originally was. But it shows that, you know, of course, she and the Tom Skerritt character, they sort of have a dalliance. So, but I do love how Altman treats her, or at least I like that how much sympathy he sort of affords to her and her character.
And I say that too, and people look at me like I'm crazy. But I think there's a lot of sympathy for Hodges. I even think there's some sympathy for Burns too, not as much, but there are
right.
a couple of scenes where actually they give him credit for doing what he does.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you find that through so many of his movies, through so many of his characters, you know, even bad guys. You know, like one of my favorite scenes in all of his movies is the scene with George Segal and Joseph Walsh in this
yes.
one scene that he's in California Split, where he plays Sparky, his bookie. And, you know, and his character, it's just this one scene. And he's, of course, the screenwriter. But you know, he's fed up with George Segal. You understand where he's coming from, and he's going to, you know, break his legs or beat him up if he doesn't pay him. And in another movie, he would be treated as sort of a heavy, but he comes in there and explains to him, and you've watched George Segal just blow, you know, his winnings and get on these losing streaks and can't get out, you know. And so you understand his point of view, and he's sympathetic to him. He's like, I got to make a living too. My parents are out here. I'm getting killed. So, you know, I love that you see that throughout all of his movies.
Well, you know, we talked about Mark Rydell playing the Jewish gangster. You
right.
Got him too. Even with what he does.
Oh, you love him. And he does like the most heinous thing in the world. I mean, you know, he smashes that Coke bottle, you know, across that girl's face. It's just like one of the like most horrific things in all of his filmography. And you know, yeah, you still like Marty Augustine somehow.
Seriously.
Yeah.
You know, a friend of mine, my former partner, always said about that movie, even the cops. Even everybody, it's just business. You know, we're beating you up. It's just business. No, it's nothing personal.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. I love that and the long goodbye. And oh, even like back in the McCabe and Mrs. Miller, the guy that comes, the assassin that comes to town. You know, you love that the guy in the big bear, the big burly guy who with the big mustache.
We have not mentioned McCabe, which is considered one of his best films. Now, I'm not as enamored of it as other people. I love Julie Christie in it. Warren Beatty is slightly miscast. But that's me.
I got you. I mean, I respect that. I really do like him in that movie. But you know, there's obviously some friction there, and there was, and there's a reason they never worked together again.
Right.
That was apparently not a pleasant experience for Warren Beatty, nor Robert Altman in terms of dealing, I think, with Warren Beatty.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too.
But it's a gorgeous film, and you know it's got some of the music in that. We talked about the music earlier with John Williams and the Long Goodbye.
Ooh,
the
Leonard Cohen
utilization, the Leonard Cohen songs are just just such, you know, how that movie is, that those songs are so ingrained in that movie. I think I've heard Sisters of Mercy, I think maybe I've heard it in another movie, and it's just, I cannot not think of McCabe and Mrs. Miller when I hear that song.
Oh, absolutely. You know, but that also brings something else up that I think we at least ought to touch, is that Altman's love of music. I mean, let's not forget things like Kansas City, which was basically his pion, not only to his hometown, but to the music and the jazz.
Yes.
And his sense of music, he even did a segment of the film Aria. You know, he staged
Aria.
He staged operas. He had a great love of music, and it comes through in almost every film he ever did.
Yeah, and it's weird, too, because it's real understated. You don't really think of Altman as a music aficionado. He's not a needle drop director, really. I mean, you know, he doesn't use a lot of pop songs to, you know, counterpoint what's going on the screen. I mean, but it's all very diegetic, and it feels very organic to the piece. But you know, you're right. I mean, that's a big part of his movies. And you know, Kansas City, you bring up. Boy, what a late career gem that one is. I mean, that's such a great, great movie that I think is still a little underseen.
Well,
some
I agree too.
We could say.
And if you want, you know, if you don't think Harry Belafonte is a good actor, you know, check that out, and then do a double feature of The Angel Levine, and your mind will be changed. Trust me.
Right. How? I was shocked that he wasn't nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Kansas City. What and what is there a better gangster name than Seldom Seen? I love that character name, Seldom Seen. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, great thing. And then let's not forget the company Evil, which was his. You know, the one with Neve Campbell and Malcolm McDowell, and ballet. I mean, you know, and again, you're right. It's very in the moment. I mean, everything is it's not placed on top, but it's very ingenuous in terms of how he uses music and that. It's just part of the background.
There's parts of the live performance stuff of the company that sort of recalls to me A Perfect Couple, even though Perfect Couple is not one of my favorites of his by a long shot, speaking of another movie that's got a lot of music in it. But the way that, you know, with the rainstorm and the outdoor performance, that's very, you know, very dramatic. And I love what I love about the company. And the music in the company is really great. It's Van Dyke Parks, who obviously he did the orchestrations for Popeye. And I'm a big Van Dyke Parks fan, but I love how even late in his career and the company is, I think it's right before Tanner on Tanner, and Prairie Home Companion being his last. So even though that late in his career, he's still being very experimental because the company is not the movie that you might think it is. It's very kind of almost like its own ballet. It's a very interesting movie, and it's very interestingly told. And so even though I think the company is the one that still works on me each time I see it, it's the one that I find that I have more and more respect for and find more and more interesting each time I see it.
Yeah, that one for me is Quintet. The one that I've had to rewatch a number of times to really like get where he was going with it, you know. And that one is slightly off-putting to say the least, but yet I think it's a great film.
Oh yes, that's the one. My wife absolutely does not like Quintet at all, and it's a running kind of joke in our home how much she can't stand Quintet. I like it better than her. It's one of those movies I can understand anybody's opinion on it. I can respect anybody's opinion on Quintet. I think it's an interesting film. I don't know if I know exactly if Robert Altman knows what he's saying, but I love how, you know, that I love the commitment to this very unusual thing that he had just kind of concocted. You know, some story that he and a couple of his actors came up with. Under these conditions that Quintet was shot in, I'm surprised more people didn't get hurt and die on that set. I mean,
yeah, seriously.
That thing, and I love the sense of place. I love the Wolf Kroeger's production design. Again, just like Popeye. That's another thing. Robert Altman is so good when he wants to make a movie about a place that's very unique. Quintet and Popeye shows that he was able to do that. Those are very unique cinematic worlds that he created. I do like Quintet quite a bit, but you know, I understand everybody's opinion on Quintet, I totally get. You know, so, people that think it's a masterpiece, I get it. People that hate it, I get it, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And again, very divisive. So there are three things I want to touch on before we call it a night. And one is a film that we have not talked about, and I think we need to, and that's Three Women.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. That's like probably my second favorite Altman film. Go ahead, just you start off.
Basically, what he considers his dream film. That he had a dream and came up with this thing. And, of course, it's sort of like single white female on acid, I guess. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
But basically.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, or persona, you know, in Palm Springs or something. I mean, it's.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about basically switching identities between Sissy Spacek and Shelley Duvall. Shelley Duvall at first is the very outgoing, and Sissy is the very, very much the blossoming or non-blossoming flower, let's put it that way. And then, of course, throughout, they change personas. Then the third woman is the person that's seen it all through like peripherally, and that would be Janice Rule.
Yes.
It is not one of my favorites. I find it really, really thick and hard to get through. But how can you not be amazed by the acting? Seriously.
Oh, right. I can see it because it's an unusual movie and thick is a good description for it. I love it. I am always every time I watch it. That's another one I find I see a lot each time I watch it. I feel like I put another piece of the puzzle together, even though I know it'll never make sense because Altman would say the same thing. It's going to make sense to however you want it to make sense. It's very pre-David Lynch in a way. But I do love how it unfolds. It gets downright creepy. And you know, the performance of Shelley Duvall and Sissy Spacek, those performances are just out of this world. I mean, I think they're both career best, possibly. Maybe in the case of Sissy Spacek, there might be something out there that's better. But, I mean, that transformation where they swap personalities in the middle is just an incredible feat of acting. And to be able to pull that off as such a young and experienced actress shows how preternaturally gifted Sissy Spacek is, or was,
well,
as an actress.
Well, they've been around for a while. Let's not forget Carrie, and let's not forget Badlands. She basically was punching pretty well at that point.
I'm also a gigantic Coal Miner's Daughter fan. I mean, I think she's incredible. In that, I'm, but the three women where you get to see both sides of them, you know. Now, Carrie probably runs a close second to me. I love how mousy and then how sultry she is. I love, it's kind of like watching Laura Dern in Inland Empire, how she can just float from one kind of character to the next. It's just really amazing to me. Carrie, I'm never going to take away from her performance in Carrie, which I think is absolutely stunning. And also, by the way, back to the music in Three Women, I think is amazing. It's very haunting, and very unusual.
Absolutely.
I think
in terms of, it just seems to fit. It doesn't overstay or overwhelm you by any means. It's just there.
Right.
And that's something I think Altman really was a master at.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about music because now we got one more that we need to talk about. We're going to get Rachel in on this. Is when you talk about final films of a director, okay, that has had a career as long as Altman did, and we didn't even go back to the James Dean story in the 50s and the delinquents. But, you know, he'd been doing films since the 50s. And then in the early 2000s, he does A Prairie Home Companion. And basically, this is his movie to say goodbye, and he knows it. Of course, they bring in Paul Thomas Anderson to basically ghost the film just in case he passed away. But how perfect is that movie as a statement from Altman saying basically goodbye?
If that's how you see it, it's a great movie.
And that's how I see it. There's no problem.
Yeah. I agree. You know, I don't know of, other than maybe David Bowie with Black Star, I don't know of another artist that I've seen stick the landing in quite the same emotionally impactful way as Robert Altman. There, I don't know if there's any other way to see Prairie Home Companion than him. I mean, there's no possible. Huh?
But there is, but we'll get to that in a moment. But go ahead, Doc.
Okay. The idea there, I know there's always this, oh, well, he had other projects that he was working on and all this. Look, an octogenarian who had leukemia, who had to get a ghost director just to get bonded to make a movie, has got to know that their days of working are probably over. And I mean, he must have known that. And that's why I find The Prairie Home Companion, it's in my top 10, Robert Altman. And I find it very emotional, because it's so perfect in what it's doing and what he's trying to convey, which is, this is just what happens. I mean, you know, that things die, things close down, everybody goes. It's just part of life. And you're left with your memories. And I love how the ending, it's sort of a celebration. It's sort of like a funeral almost. Because I've always felt when the Virginia Madsen character walks into that diner, she's saying that she's come for Robert Altman. That's the way I see that last shot in the movie.
Oh, I do too. Now, we have another opinion on this. So, Rachel, we're going to let you go. Go for it, my dear.
All right. I do have an opinion on this. And so I will say that, first off, I watched the movie not knowing that Robert Altman was dying, ghost directing, blah, blah, blah. I watched the movie because I have a very close, very personal connection to The Prairie Home Companion. So when I saw the movie expecting anything even remotely like The Prairie Home Companion that got me through church. I mean, I hated going to church so much, but I loved the car ride home because we'd listened to The Prairie Home Companion, and I absolutely fell in love with it. It always reminded me of that movie, I think, what is it, Lady in Red, where they're doing the radio show, and
yeah.
I loved it. And so when I saw Prairie Home Companion, not knowing these things about it that I know now, it was not Prairie Home Companion for me because there were too many big faces. There were so many recognizable people that it just felt so inauthentic to me. And so that really, really bothered me because it was so personal for me for most of my life that I was like, oh, my God, somebody else actually knows what The Prairie Home Companion is? They made a fucking movie about it? Like, I am on for this. And then I see, like, Lindsay Lohan, Lily Tomlin, Virginia Madsen, all these people. And not that they were bad in the movie. They were great performances. And you'll find me hard-pressed to say that about Lohan, but she has, in her day, actually nailed it once in a while. But, yeah, it was such a crushing disappointment to me. I mean, I can see now, like, if I go back and watch the movie, I'll probably have a completely different perspective on it. But at that time, it just really struck me so wrong. And the fact that, you know, they still do the Prairie Home Companion, and it was, you know, they're like ending the show and everything in this movie. And I get it now. I totally do. But I'm never going to be able to go back to that moment when I thought it was the Prairie Home Companion and not just in spirit.
Well, you know,
right.
One other thing about
I can,
Rachel, is that, you know, let's not forget Prairie Home Companion was radio. So you made your
exactly.
own images. You made your own
I
images.
I didn't want to
so
know what these people looked like.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
and if
I, mean,
I was going to see these faces, I didn't want to see a face that I'd seen 30,000 other times, because I'm sorry, Virginia Madsen's fucking hot. She is great at what she does. But she's Virginia Madsen. I recognize that woman in every kind of disguise because she is Virginia Madsen. And, I mean, so it
right.
really struck me that if you're going to try to do this, like, at least, you know, keep some of the mystery alive. And that was it. It was a radio show. And when they show all of these big, huge actors, I mean, yeah, they did a perfect job of making his final film for him, but they did not, I feel, honor Prairie Home Companion in a way that they could have.
I can understand that. I mean, you know, if it, and I like, you know, Prairie Home Companion and Lake Wobegon stuff, the Garrison Killer stuff as well. But I didn't have that kind of connection to it. But, you know, it's probably kind of like people who read Naked Lunch and then went to see Naked Lunch, hoping to see that book, you know, kind of like represented in a way that was like, because that's not what that movie is. It's more about the writing of Naked Lunch. So,
right.
you know, I guess it's an expectation thing. And I can see where as a Prairie Home Companion fan, you know, a movie coming out about it and then going to see it, how that would be a little disconcerting and disappointing. I can understand that completely.
See, and like I said, I could probably watch it now, knowing what I do, and, you know, I'm much older, of course, and see it for that. And I can understand that. I'm going to say that just because of my first, like, visceral reaction to it, it's never going to be one of my favorite movies. I'm probably not even going to like it, but I can understand it better now.
All right,
that's good. You can't like everything everyone else likes. That's the case.
Absolutely.
No, I mean,
that
that's what makes us individuals, and that's what makes us, you know, have discussions about it and try to change your mind, and maybe your mind isn't changed, but at least you're open to the other person's opinion, which is always a good thing. So this brings up one other question that I wanted to bring up, and it's perfect to do it since we're talking about Prairie Home Companion. You know that Paul Thomas Anderson ghosted the film. And what I want to ask is there any director, including Paul Thomas Anderson, that you feel is Altman's true protege, someone who really took Altman and brought it in a different direction?
Not really. I mean, I guess I guess some people would say Alan Rudolph, but I don't see a lot of Altman in Alan Rudolph, even though he was his actual protege. I think he tried, like with movies like I Love L.A., you know, but I don't, you know, I would say Paul Thomas Anderson is close.
I don't think he has the heart.
No, I mean, he's a little more cynical. I think Magnolia and Boogie Nights are and Punch Drunk Love have a lot of heart to them. But I mean, you start getting into like There Will Be Blood and The Master, those are pretty acrid. You know, Wes Anderson has a true love for his characters.
Yes.
But he's almost Woody Allen meets Hal Ashby with a Jacques Tati skin.
I had never thought about that. I'm going to have to remember that. Woody Allen meets Hal Ashby. I like that. I like that.
Oh, thank you. But there's something Altman-esque about the way he loves his characters, and even the scoundrels. There's a certain humanism there in his movies. I think that people disregard because of their style. But you know, as far as technique and the having all of the characters, that would be something like a Paul Thomas Anderson, but again, like he's missing the heart, you know. Altman was just sort of unique.
See, I would say that Rudolph is his protege, not just for the fact that Rudolph worked with him, but in terms of character, there is a major difference between Altman and Rudolph. Altman is a humanist. Rudolph is a romantic. And so his characters were about, you know, opposites attract or humans attract and what keeps them apart and what finally brings them together. And also that the sense of place that you take a look at Made in Heaven, which is one of my favorite Rudolph films, and how he depicts heaven. Remember My Name, Excuse Me. These films, you can feel Altman in them, but they're different because Altman's not behind them, somebody else is. But there's a lot of DNA there. And
no,
so
yeah,
I always say, if you like Altman and you don't know Rudolph, Go watch some Alan Rudolph films. Seriously.
I hear that Trouble in Mind, so I was just alerted that Trouble in Mind, I guess, is streaming on Amazon Prime right now, which is exciting to me because I haven't seen that movie in forever. And speaking of a real sense of place, Trouble in Mind was one of my favorite Alan Rudolph movies in the 80s for sure.
Oh, absolutely. I had my former partner, the gentleman by the name of Stephen Ronquillo, and he loves, absolutely loves Trouble in Mind. And one of the greatest reasons he loves Trouble in Mind is that it has one of the most distaff performances from Divine ever in a film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And
that was the, yeah.
You know, and he plays not in drag, he plays it straight. As a gangster boss. And boy, is he a scary dude in that movie.
He's awesome in that movie. Trouble in Mind shows just what a loss it was, because that was Divine was trying to do other roles outside of drag performance. And that was one. And it's just a great one, and you can really see what a loss, you know, and what an opportunity. We did not get to see the full acting spectrum, I think, of Divine, because he's so great in that movie, just so great. It's so not what you would think.
Exactly. And that's the other thing about Rudolph, is his work with actors. Because there are a couple of exceptions, Breakfast of Champions, which I should not mention. But most of his films, the actors just work so well together.
Yeah. No, I do agree with that for sure.
So any final thoughts on Altman or pick a film that we haven't mentioned?
You know, we've talked about all the greats, I think, that we pretty much I know there's going to be one when we, you know, get all. Oh, you know what we haven't talked about that I do want to mention, and we talked about three women, talked a little bit about Images with Suzanne York, I think, that which is Altman's sort of one horror movie. But the movie that I think that gets slept on the most is That Cold Day in the Park with Sandy Dennis. And I would love for people, when, you know, because MASH is the one that everybody sort of starts with because it's his big hit. It's the thing that put him on the map. Go one back to That Cold Day in the Park. I think that movie is really, really great. I think it's where you start seeing a lot of his style come in. Sandy Dennis gives a remarkable performance. I just don't think enough people have seen that movie. And I urge people to do what you can to see That Cold Day in the Park, which is a 1969.
Made in Canada. It is, for me, it's sort of almost a precursor to a certain degree of Three Women.
Yeah.
To a certain degree. But, and I don't think he's in total control. However, it's very apparent that he's working with the actors, and particularly Sandy Dennis, who I think is very underrated as an actress.
For sure.
I love him. You know, and the other one we have not mentioned is Jimmy Dean.
Right, which I love.
Which we just did in June, a whole Pride Month, and I almost picked Jimmy Dean to do a commentary watch on, but decided not to because I just thought it was a little too heavy. But, you know, as I said at the beginning, we're going to be doing a podcast with Stephen Eckleberry, and Karen Black. Is just, I mean, there isn't anyone in that cast that doesn't do a fabulous job. And it's one of Kathy Bates' first films, by the way. But Karen Black just, oh my God.
She's
so
amazing
pretty.
In that movie. And, you know, of course, she's so great in Nashville. She's not in it for very much, but she's amazing in Nashville. But I'm a huge Karen Black fan. Always loved Karen Black. Always much respect for Karen Black. So, but yes, Five and Dime is tremendous, and it's a tremendous movie. And it's, again, that was a pretty brave movie. This is the thing that he did after getting ejected from Hollywood. This is the project that he chooses, which is pretty progressive for cinema in, you know, the early 80s.
Well, he did two movies. He did that in Screamers.
Well, then if you count Beyond Therapy, I guess, if you want to count three.
No, I don't want to count Beyond Therapy. Sorry, no.
I'm just so not looking forward to going through that movie again, but I'm going to give it that's very atypical for the 80s. He was just always that, you know, I mean, that's what I love about him. And I think that my final thought on Robert Altman was he was as much a maverick as Cassavetes. He just had a bigger bullhorn and a wider pool. And I think what he created, you know, he said that it was all one film to him. His entire filmography was just one big piece. And when you go through his work in chronological order, you see that. You see how his ideas form and how they sort of fold in on each other, and movies from the past inform movies of the future. Like, you know, the Virginia Madsen character is nothing but the Sally Kellerman character from Brewster McCloud, a whole other movie we haven't discussed that's great. And there's so much to mine in his filmography. There's so many different kinds of movies, and it's just so wonderful. And there's nobody that's going to forget Steven Spielberg, and nobody's going to forget Martin Scorsese or Coppola or those filmmakers. There's a real risk, I think, that Robert Altman in future generations gets forgotten because, you know, he's not flashy. He doesn't, you know. But that would be a shame, because I really do think that what he documented in his lifetime is really special, and I think it's timeless. And I really hope that throughout the years and throughout the generations, that his work and his name are kept alive.
I agree wholeheartedly. So right now what we're going to do is we're going to do a little bit of housekeeping. Please stick with us, Patrick, because I got a couple things to ask you after this. So we've got upcoming shows. Now I just want to do a quick recap of what we did this week. And these are all valuable to listen to. And you can find this on the Deviant Legion page or the ISF page. Number one is on Monday we had Joe Lansdale, and he talked about his new book and also a documentary that was made of him, and we had him. And then on Tuesday, we had Doug Stone, and Doug is a voice actor. And he is now featured in the new Netflix Resident Evil anime. That is showing
like
now.
So many other animes. Oh my God, so many really good and really classic. Even the guy's been in the field for 40 fucking years, I think.
Seriously. And then of course yesterday we did a commentary with John Killian on A Dark Song. Today, of course, we've got The Omen. And on Friday, Adam is going to do Cathode Ray Mission and focusing on an English miniseries called Our Friends in the North. On Saturday, we're going to do a commentary watch of My Hidden 70s Gems, and this would be the Nickel Ride. And then upcoming, we've got a couple of shows. And Patrick, if you're interested, you're certainly welcome to come on. We're going to be doing in the next week. They're not set specifically, but in the next 2 weeks, we're going to be doing shows both on Robert Downey Sr. and William Smith. And also, if you want to be involved in the Karen Black show, I'll definitely get you on for that. Seriously, if you want to do that.
Okay.
So I'll keep you informed on that. Rachel, there's a show that we're going to be doing on the 24th that you should talk about.
Let's see. Oh, on Down the Rabbit Hole, we are going to be continuing our music series. This time we'll be doing novelty songs. No, I'm not talking about like what would you do for a Klondike bar, but a bunch of different things, you know, none of these, but like Hello Mata, Hello Fada, things like that. Novelty songs. So
Weird Al Yankovic either.
He deserves a job of his own. He does. So no Weird Al on this one, just because that's too easy. You know that down the rabbit hole, we're going to take you way down in the burrows. So we're going to find some really, really interesting stuff. And TC is going to be joining us again, Mr. Tom Clark. I am so stoked about that. He was so much fun last time. I think he's going to keep up with us on the music shows. So welcome to the network, TC.
Absolutely. And I must say that John Killian, who I did the commentary watch yesterday, will be a regular guest on our shows. And hopefully we can talk Patrick into doing that too. So we'll see how that all works.
Oh, yeah.
So Patrick, do me a favor and just do a little bit of promoting of your stuff and so on.
Personal bump.
Well, my personal bump is that I'm currently, like you said, I'm doing the Robert Altman series, and all of my stuff can be found over at podcastingthemsoftly.com. That's where all of my essays are housed, and I'm also doing a podcast series over there with my friend Frank Mangarelli. We're working on the we're going through the filmography of Abel Ferreira. That's our actual podcast series, but I'm also doing written essays on the filmographies of Russ Meyer and Michael Mann and Jack Hill. And I think in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to introduce Toby Hooper, and I'm going to do his as well, much like I'm doing the Altman. But I'm also doing those filmmakers, and that should probably do me for the year, because that'll keep me backed up probably until December. But that's, like I said, that's all over at podcastingandsoftly.com. All you have to do is you can type my name in there in the search engine and find all my stuff. It's in there. All in there.
Cool. That Fair name way. Would be Patrick Crane, C-R-A-I-N.
Correct.
With a K.
That's right.
Yes, Rachel Keats. Rachel keeps all the notes. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, yes, and I'm the one that likes to remind people how to spell things in case they do want to look you up. It's what I'm here for.
Probably a good idea, since my last name is always misspelled C-R-A-N-E.
Right.
Yes, and I kind of figured that, so that was my contribution to you.
Good looking out. Thank you very much.
Well, folks, we want to thank you very, very much for joining us. And Patrick, as I said, you're always welcome back anytime.
If Carl doesn't die.
Come back, yes. Right.
Yeah, this is true. Sinuses, what can I tell you? It's got 95 degrees and humid like crazy here in the city. It's like, God help me.
Yeah, that's
so
terrible.
Anyway, again, thank you very much, Patrick, for being on with us. And we're all basically going to say good night.
Good night, everybody.
All right, thank you. Y'all still here?